So our second speaker, again, to lay the framework for the meeting is Nico. So I'll turn it over to Nico to discuss the technical challenges.
There were no technical challenges mentioned in the earlier talk.
No.
So I'm just going to add a few more. And I don't think my talk is going to be quite as long. I'll focus on a few important technical challenges, challenges that I think are important. But maybe first, what technical challenges? Because as Tom showed you in 2008 and then also later, several groups produced nice high-resolution structures of icosahedral viruses that are good enough now to build atomic models from scratch, if you want to. And so everything seems to be good. And we are there where we wanted to be 10 years ago. But when you look at the theoretical predictions of how well we should be able to do, given the signal-noise ratio that we expect at a certain dose that we use in these images, then Richard Henderson and Bob Glaser predicted that we should actually only need a few thousand images or molecules to average in order to get to 3.5 angstrom resolution or so. But when you look at papillomavirus, the structure that I just showed you, you can count 1.5 million molecules of L1, the code protein, that needed to be averaged to get to that resolution. And so it is very clear that we are still quite a way off the ideal situation that should be possible, physically possible, with cryo-EM. And so my talk is partly about the reasons why we are not there, and then some of the steps that people are currently considering to overcome these problems. So traditionally, one of the specimens that have been used in order to study the quality of images have been 2D crystals, and this just shows a low-dose image of purple membrane that was collected with Fritz Semlin and Erich Beckmann in Berlin on a liquid helium microscope there at 200 kilovolts. And the reason why these 2D crystals are nice specimens to use for image characterization is that it is very easy to distinguish the noise and the signal. You just Fourier transform the image and then get the spot pattern, and the signal is all concentrated in these spots and the noise is all in between the spots. And so you can measure very nicely signal noise ratios, the fading of spots, and so on and so forth. And of course, you can also then easily filter the image and calculate with an inverse Fourier transform a filtered projection, in this case, of the crystal. Now, an interesting experiment is to cut out from this filtered image one unit cell. It's worth about 100 kilodaltons when you add the lipid to it, and then go back into the noisy image to see if you can detect individual unit cells just by cross-correlation. And that is done over here. You see these peaks. I mean, there are many peaks, but there are some brighter peaks, and they form a nice hexagonal pattern that tells you that we correctly identify the position of the unit cells here. And so apart from the number of a few thousand images needed to get to high resolution, Henderson and Richard and Bob also predicted that the limit of the smallest thing that you can actually or should be able to align in cryo images should be something like between 10 and 50 kilodaltons. So this is still a little bit away, and of course this is also not the kind of specimen that they were considering, because this here sits on a carbon film, so it adds some noise. The other thing that is not quite correct here in comparing the theoretical predictions with this here is that here we are only looking for alignments, whereas in the normal single particle case you would have to find 5 parameters, 3 angles and the XY position. So it's not quite a fair comparison for several reasons, but still tells you about a limit, because as I'm going to show you later, if this is not quite as good quality here, you will actually not find these peaks anymore. So these images were pretty good. We got 2.6 angstrom in projection, from six of these images averaged together. That compared quite well with an earlier study by Richard at 2.8. These here were improved a little bit because we extracted some lipids, and presumably some contacts here were improved between the protein. And the improvement can be quantified with a so-called temperature factor, or B factor. And so I'm going to talk about these B factors a little more in my talk because they turn out to be convenient in characterizing the amount of degradation, signal degradation, or improvement when you improve your imaging method. And so here, the B factor can be measured by fitting a straight line in such a plot where you plot the image amplitudes or the ratio of the image amplitudes against the diffraction amplitudes. And so usually the image amplitudes fade more against the diffraction amplitudes. And then there's a slope that can be converted into a B factor here, about 140. This here was 180. So the small improvement, the smaller the B factor, the better the images were. The small improvement here would go along with a slightly improved resolution. But you know, I don't think it's that significant, actually. And so you can ask, what are the reasons why there is such a B factor? What things in the images lead to degradation of the amplitudes? And so in this case, there were two factors that could be considered probably. One is a B factor that comes from the damage, the beam damage to the protein. And I'm going to talk about this a little more. And the other is probably a B factor that's due to the detective quantum efficiency of the film in this case. So you're going to lose some signal at higher resolution. And again, I'm going to talk about this a little more. So considering these two factors, you expect a B factor of 110, which is a little smaller than this. So maybe the rest is coming from something like beam-induced movement or so. But so it's this kind of consideration that is useful in identifying other possible issues. I just wanted to say there are other things that can, of course, lead to attenuation of amplitudes, but that will not affect the signal-noise ratio. And I'm going to pretend that all the B factors that I'm looking at here will purely affect the signal-to-noise ratio, and everything else that just affected the amplitudes I will have corrected for. Okay, so the B factors here are meant to assess directly the signal-to-noise ratio. Okay, so coming back to the virus. So I was trying to estimate the B factor here of this reconstruction in a similar way, and it depends actually on where you measure this. So at around 10 angstrom, there's a stretch that is pretty straight and gives a B factor of 510 angstrom squared. But then if you consider a range, resolution range that goes to higher resolution, the B factor seems to be smaller. So it's actually not so clear which B factor one should consider in order to assess the quality of the images. And so let's look at what kind of B factors would be generated with different degradation mechanisms. So again, we have beam damage and the detector. And from recent work with Melody Campbell here at Scripps, we also know that we have a B factor of about 160 angstrom squared from beam-induced movement with particles sitting in ice. And then from other work on rotavirus with Steve Harrison and James Chen worked on it, and Jing Zhang and so on, we estimated the alignment error and also the focus error. And so parameter errors in the image processing will probably generate another B factor, maybe of 90 angstrom squared. And I want to say at this point that these precise numbers here are not precise. They are all estimates, and different people will probably calculate them differently. But they put, they give you an idea of what order of magnitude we're dealing with all these different factors. And of course, now we can talk about each one of them and how we can improve them with technical developments and so on and so forth. Okay, and so the total B factor resulting from all of these problems is about 380. And that's sort of in between this B factor and this B factor. And as I said, it's not so clear which one should be used. You can also look at this plot here that I took out of Peter Rosenthal, Richard Henderson's JMB paper in 2003. That's mainly cited for its resolution cutoff. that plot here shows you how many particles would be needed, actually here 64 particles, would be needed in order, when you have a given B factor, to achieve a certain resolution. Okay, and so I just calculated for this particular reconstruction, we used about 4,000 particles, but we had an additional six-fold symmetry on top of the axial symmetry, so we had about 24,000 60-fold particles, which puts us around here, and the resolution of 3.6 angstroms might be about here. And so it looks like from that plot, one would say the B factor, effective B factor, was closer to 250. Anyway, so somewhere in that area. But the bottom line is these are the different problem areas that could improve the B factor, no matter what exactly we have for this in this particular case. So I'm going to talk about those for a little bit. Beam-induced movement, charging, detector DQE, beam damage, and alignment errors. So there's been a very nice paper by Bob Glaser and Richard Henderson on beam-induced movement observed in paraffin crystals. And the only way the movement could be reduced reliably was to use a thicker carbon film. Okay, so the mechanical stability of the support film was the most important determining factor for success. And this here just shows a tilted image where you can see that the carbon film here shows a lot of wrinkles, and those probably come or are due to the different expansion coefficients between copper and the carbon itself, and also the paraffin crystals in carbon. And so you can see here in different places there are wrinkles in the carbon film that correlate with the position of the crystals. And so all of these things that lead to a non-flat, there's some feedback, I'm sorry, non-flat support films probably also contribute to the movement because they give more room for local movement, and the rest of the film will not be able to hold the particular area that you expose in place. Okay, so in order to improve beam-induced movement, you have to have more mechanical stability and probably also a flatter support film for 2D crystals. You know, for single particles and ice, of course, we'll have to do other things. And so one thing that I investigated here when I was on sabbatical together with Bridget and Clint, and this is a work by Axel Leor, a graduate student from my lab who came here for a few weeks to collect some data, was to collect movies. And then later we carried on with this work to actually calculate reconstructions. And Melody Campbell worked on this. to record movies. And so this just shows a movie recorded by one of the new types of detectors, direct electron detector DE12. That's the model from direct electron. And so, you know, these new detectors, they have probably two most important features. One is the improved DQE, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. And the other is that you can record at a fairly high frame rate, here in this case, 40 frames per second. And so this allows you to follow whatever is happening while you expose the sample to the electron beam. And so in this case, the movie starts, you know, blank, and then frames are added to the average. And so the image becomes clearer and clearer when you focus in here, up here. What you can see is initially the virus particles, you know, sharpen up, but then they become streaky. Okay, so later in the movie, they become streaky in this direction. And that's due to the beam-induced movement in this particular case. So you can collect these movies and try to correct for this movement just by tracking these particles, because now you have them sitting in different films at different positions, so you can align them just like you do with other single particles. One of the problems that we will find we have to deal with as we move more and more to this technology is that there's a lot of data that we have to deal with. So in this particular case, this movie here was worth about 720 megabytes, and if you collect a full data set of 500 or 1,000 pictures, you'll have several, soon terabytes of data to deal with. Okay, so that's something probably can be solved with money, but it needs to be considered. So in this particular case, you can turn an image like this into a very nice and sharp image just by aligning these frames. All right. So this was about beam-induced movement and charging. The charging part, I thought I mentioned a very nice work by John Berryman and Peter Rosenthal, who investigated a paraxial charge compensation method. The idea is that you drill a few more holes in your C2 aperture, and they produce off-axis beams. So this would be the hole that you expose and you collect data on. But then at the same time you expose this hole, there are other beams that are hitting the carbon nearby. And the charge that normally evolves here in the hole, because electrons are knocked out and therefore there's a positive charge, will be partially compensated by other electrons that are being ejected in the surrounding area and then sort of are attracted by the positive charge and rain down on that to compensate. Okay, so that would be a way to reduce some of the charging here. All right, so next up would be the detector DQE. And actually, this is a topic that I thought I should expand because it really goes in towards contrast in general. So, DQE improves contrast, but there are actually other ways to improve image contrast. And so I just am going to make that a little more general and talk about contrast. And so we have better detectors. I'm going to talk about or show you briefly a low voltage image with very nice contrast. Faceplates, of course, we already heard about dealing with inelastic scattering, and then an interesting idea with astigmatism. So Tom already said that for him the biggest improvement or most exciting development in the field are these new detectors. He likes them because he likes the movies, but I think equally exciting is also the improvement in the DQE, and there's a wonderful study by Greg McMullen and Richard where they basically explain the whole, everything that you need to know about DQEs. Okay, so they, I mean, I've read the paper a lot now. They compare film and the more traditional scintillator-based CCDs and the new type direct electron detectors. And this was an older model. This was a paper from 2009. Of course, now we have better versions. Chris Booth and Benjamin Bams will talk about it, and there will also be a discussion panel led by David Agard. I just wanted to show, so one example of this new type of detector is the GATAN K2 summit that's taken from the GATAN webpage, where you now see a wonderful curve with a DQE at Nyquist of something like almost 30%. As Greg and Richard pointed out in their paper, the theoretical limit for such a detector at Nyquist should be more like 0.5. That's assuming you don't use any kind of super resolution mode where you do profile fitting to get sub-angstrom accuracy with your single electron counting. If you do that, of course, you can bring this up further. And so, comparing these two, there's still, even though the K2 is already a fantastic detector, it can be even better. Okay. Low voltage is a technique that I think different labs have now tried out. This is work by from Sriram Subramanian's lab. He was looking at a small trimer GP140 HIV in ice. So the molecular weight of the trimer is 420 kilodaltons, and at 80 kilovolts, he gets a wonderful contrast that, of course, helps him to align these particles much better than at, when the contrast is lower. And so low voltage would be one way to increase your contrast if you have very thin samples. And with thicker samples, you get more significant multiple scattering and inelastic scattering. All right, faceplate, and we're going to talk. You're going to hear about this also from other people, and therefore I'm not going to talk about it too much. Is also a possibility to increase contrast, especially at low resolution. And Tom and I think others have said that this is particularly important for tomography. But I think that one very important area will also be the single particle alignment, because when you align particles, and that's something that I think Richard is going to talk about in his talk, when you align single particles, actually the low resolution formation is very, very important. And strengthening that will help you get the alignment correct, but also it will prevent you more from overfitting and overinterpreting your data. And so that's something that I think Richard will talk about in his work. And so the faceplates will allow you to work with smaller things. It will allow you to align things more reliably. And so I think it's going to be equally important for single particles. Okay, so Wachu and Bob will talk about this. I just wanted to say one thing. There are a lot of technical problems with faceplates. And when you have a faceplate that acts by putting some material into the beam, then you have to come up with tricks in order to prevent any kind of charging or contamination. Okay, so that's, I think, going to be a general problem every time you put some material in the beam. I'm not saying it can't be solved, but it's a problem that you would have with that. And so here, this is a paper by John Spence, and Bob Glaser was also on it, where they discussed the possibility of having a very intense laser beam that would then produce a strong light field here in this optical cavity. And then by Compton scattering, you would also get a phase shift. And so that sounds like science fiction and hasn't been realized. But according to the paper, it would be theoretically possible. And so maybe that's something, looking into the future, we might be able to achieve. Inelastic scattering, I just briefly mentioned it with the low voltage, is something that people usually ignore. When you do tomography, you use an energy filter to clean up your image a little bit, but that's about it. If you could, the inelastic scattering is actually quite a bit compared to, usually even a little more than the elastic scattering. And it normally just produces some background that will lower your overall contrast. And when you use an energy filter and place the energy window on 25 electrons per meter squared, as we've done here, this was data collected by our facility manager, Chen Zhu, you see that the loss electrons actually still have some ability to interfere and form an image. Okay, so they're not totally useless. And of course, this was an energy window of 15 eV, just to have enough signal go through here. But if we had a chromatic aberration corrector, it might be possible to use all these electrons to contribute to the elastic image and improve the contrast that way. But of course, it's a terribly expensive piece of equipment. And so here, maybe I'll be criticized for doing this, but I also wanted to mention an idea that I thought was interesting from Marin's lab, to use very high astigmatism to generate lower resolution contrast in one direction and preserve the high resolution contrast in another direction. So that here's basically the idea is to get the good of both worlds and did this, you know, they tried it out on hemocyanin. It's not been published yet, and I don't have personal experience with it, but I thought before one rejects it, one should investigate it a little more. Okay, so those are the contrast-enhancing steps. And to summarize the effects of correcting for these different problems, I was just plotting here the, you know, a B-factor curve, an exponential, basically, that corresponds to this B-factor and would show you how much amplitudes would be attenuated due to this B-factor. If we now get rid of beam-induced motion, we would have this. If we get rid of the detector B, we would have this. And even though you can't see it here, there's an improvement at 3.5 angstroms in the amplitudes of something like 100. And in terms of signal, it would be a 12,000 times improvement. So, you know, you would have, for the same data, 12,000 times fewer particles. Possibly, you know, it's... So, next, beam damage. And there, this is a little more complicated, so I just wanted to explain. There are these curves that plot the signal-to-noise ratio at different resolutions dependent on the dose that you used for imaging your sample. Okay, so, and they have, you know, they're characterized by critical doses, NE. There are smaller critical doses for higher resolution, higher critical doses for lower resolution. They tell you basically how quickly a reflection or any other sample, how quickly the amplitudes would fade with dose. Okay, and they fade much more rapidly at high resolution. And so initially at zero dose, you have no signal, obviously. And then as you start exposing your sample, you build up signal. But at low resolution, that signal builds up more or less linearly initially, and eventually your signal fades out and you don't add anymore. Okay, that's why this flattens out here. At high resolution, you also start out linearly, but then very quickly, basically all your signal is gone, and exposing for any with any higher dose, you don't add more signal. In fact, what you do then is add noise, which is just the additional electrons that you put into the image. Okay, and so there is an optimum, in this case, for high resolution of something like 2.5 electrons per angstrom square. For at 7 angstroms, it would be an optimum more like 15 electrons per angstrom square, and at low resolution, an optimum of something like 30 electrons per angstrom square. And so for a dose of something like 25 electrons per angstrom square that we used for the papilloma virus, we optimized our image probably, you know, at the resolution of something like 30 angstroms, because we wanted to have a lot of low-resolution signal in order to align our particles. And we basically had to accept that the high-resolution signal was already significantly attenuated, or still good enough to get to 3.5 angstrom resolution. But this is why we have this B factor. If you now compare the fading, relative fading between 3 angstroms and 7 angstroms, which is about 19 times here, that would translate to a B factor of 60. Wouldn't it be nice if one could collect an image that had an optimal dose at all resolution ranges? Okay, so a single image that was optimized for 3 angstroms, 7 angstroms, and 50 angstroms. And so with these movies, and you know, if you do this, then you can reduce your B factor, in this case, for example, to about 30. John is going to talk a little about this. But I just wanted to show with movies, you can do this. And so this shows an image of hemagglutinin. Melody Campbell and Peter Lee from the Wilson Lab collected this here at Scripps. At 24 electrons per angstrom square, you see you know, a lot of noise, as expected. If you go to a high dose of about 100 electrons per angstrom square, you start seeing these trimers very nicely. And so these are now, you know, quite a bit smaller than the GP140 trimers that I showed you earlier at 80 kilo electron volts. But this image here will have lost a lot of its high-resolution information because we use this high dose. But we can use it to align our particles, and then after alignment, we can use this image, for example, for reconstruction, which still has a lot of the high-resolution signal maintained. So we can actually get both things. And of course, the right thing to do would be to apply some weighting to all the frames and have the later frames contribute only to low resolution, and the early frames also, all the way to high resolution, and then come up with a single image that is optimized at all resolutions. And just to make the point, what I showed you with the rotavirus images, how they can be corrected for beam-induced movement can also be done with these smaller particles when you do the shift alignment over the entire field, because this beam-induced movement occurs mainly by moving the entire ice sheet. So the particles in the ice remain more or less stable with respect to each other. Okay, and so here is an image that was particularly badly drifting, and so afterwards you could correct. So this is actually not only beam-induced movement, this might have drifted also because of stage instabilities. All right, so we improve our B factor from 60 to 30 and improve this even further. Okay, so it's now a factor of 200 higher here than it was originally. All right, so with better images, of course, we will also get better alignments. But the other thing that will improve our image alignments will be software. And so I just wanted to say a few words about software. So I showed you this nice image of purple membrane and the correlation map with these relatively clear correlation peaks. But now I'm going to add some noise to this, because when we start a single particle project, we don't typically begin with a perfect reference. That's the one that we want to get to. And so we'll be more in a situation like this, possibly, or in a situation like this, where you now have, you know, a much noisier representation of this 2D crystal, and your correlation peaks are mostly gone. And so in order to start aligning anything here, you basically have the big problem that there's nothing to align on. And somehow, through iteration, you're hoping to get to a better reference and therefore better correlation map that then allows you better alignment still. And so Fred Sickwith showed in 1998 very nicely, just with simulated images, that the maximum likelihood method is very noise tolerant. So if you use normal correlation alignment, basically trying to find your molecules in that very noisy correlation map that I showed you of the 2D crystal, then it's often happens that in a refinement you do not arrive at the true resolution. So this was a test with images that were derived from bacteriodopsin trimers, and when you start with a radiation symbol, you never get there. You stay with the radiation symbol. If you start with a noisy representation of your of one of your particles, you also don't get there. But with the maximum likelihood method, you do arrive at a correct representation of your structure. Okay, and so the maximum likelihood method has received a lot of attention more recently, and Shores is going to talk about this more. You can also do classification with that. Here I just introduced a tiny difference by deleting a little feature here. And so mix these together. So I had 1,000 particles of this, 1,000 particles of this, and a signal noise ratio of 1 over 50. And then I classified, again, using a maximum likelihood scheme. And the difference map between these two class averages now shows very nicely the difference that I introduced here, whereas if I do normal correlation alignment and k-means classification, I do not get that. So, you know, I mean, these methods all work with higher signal noise ratio, but at low signal noise ratio, they're more likely to fail. And, you know, the general ideas about classification, again, Shores, I think, is going to talk about, and also Powell will talk about probably ISAC. So, you know, there are many, many different new algorithms that are being developed, and I was trying to find a way to put them all together into under one heading. And this is what I finally settled on, all things considered, because what they seem to have all in common is that they are more comprehensive in including all possible aspects of the experiment. So, you know, CTF, of course, we've already, we are dealing with for a long time. Maybe they also have envelope built in, but now you can model also variability and other things. Statistical models are often used in this case where you consider particular noise distributions, particular parameter distributions, some weighting functions that allow you to discriminate more softly between good and bad rather than just throwing things out or keeping things in. You work more and more with score functions that are able to include many different kinds of data or facts about your particle, you know, like cross-linking data, homology, total mass, and so on, things that could not be combined before. And, you know, there are now schemes that will allow you to basically increase the chance that you arrive at the correct solution. People do more and more reproducibility tests, for example, multiple starts, to see if they always arrive at the same final reconstruction, consistency checks, and so on and so forth. And of course, we can also work with larger and larger data sets because of automation. And the one thing that made all this possible, apart from, of course, the fact that we all got much smarter and therefore are able to think about these new possibilities, is computers. But before I'm going to show you this, I just wanted to show one example. This is the software that Tom briefly mentioned, Felix. We're developing this, and Alex Ruhr is here with the poster. This is an example where we try to model an entire filament. These are amyloid fibers that are very flexible. And you know, rather than cutting things up and dealing with the segments as single particles, we try to keep these segments in context with their neighboring segments. And therefore, you know, if there's something misaligned here, it will also produce bad alignments in the neighborhood. Therefore, the whole thing has a much higher chance of finding the correct alignments. Okay, so, and why can we do all this? Basically because we have more powerful computers. Okay, so this is really a, I would say, of all the things that have happened in image processing, the most important thing. I remember, you know, in the late 90s at the MRC that I was struggling to Fourier transform a 10K by 10K image. But of course, this is not a problem at all anymore. And here I'm just plotting the million instructions per second of modern computers with the number of voxels in reconstructions. And those can just be bigger objects or other objects imaged at higher resolution. And you know, and how these correlate over the years. All right, and then my last or second last slide is about sample limitations. And I'm not, you know, Tom talked about this a lot, that you have to worry about heterogeneity and stability, and you know, address that typically with biochemistry and possibly also new algorithms. You can capture transient complexes. For example, with these affinity grids that Debbie Kelly might be talking about, or other methods that Debbie is going to talk about. Streptavidin crystals is another idea that was recently promoted by Fred Sickworth. Often when you work with membrane proteins, single particle in single particle mode, you're going to have problems with detergent and lipids, but there are new types of molecules that are smaller and help you align particles because the features are now clearer. The micelles aren't so big. Or there are also these amphiphilic beta strand peptides. And I think there's a poster by Arne. And then low molecular weight is a sample challenge, I thought. Holger's also going to talk about some of these. And so this is my last slide. When you talk, when you have something small like hemagglutinin that I just showed you in an earlier slide, one thing that you can do is use scaffolds. And so in, these are two different types of scaffolds that both try to align hemagglutinin. And so in this case, we use nickel NTA nanogold, and these are his-tagged hemagglutinin trimers, and they align themselves into these little rosettes. I think Holger Stark had a paper about 10 years ago on that, and so that helps you align these. You can also use rotavirus in order to display hemagglutinins. And so this has worked together with Steve Harrison, both of this actually. So this is rotavirus double layer particle. The full virus has an additional layer that is made of VP7 and another protein. VP7 can be engineered to display a hemagglutinin. And then on the other side, it binds to the capsid as it normally does. And so you end up with these very nicely displayed hemagglutinins. Down here is the virus and the VP7 outer layer. And then you have the hemagglutinin here. And so, of course, this helps you get a higher resolution map of your protein of interest because the whole virus is now displaying this particle, these molecules is now much easier to align. And I think Yifan Sheng is going to talk a little about this. All right, so I've finished, and there will be questions, and then there will be a reception.
Two things was one have also taken into consideration. One is that